Welcome to Downton.
Hello there. Emma speaking. Welcome to Shall We Go Through, the Downton Abbey fan podcast.
What?
Hi, everyone. I hope you're all doing well. And I'm really excited to be here with you to talk about episode 2 of season 5 of Downton Abbey. So I hope you are well, because we are entering one of my favourite storylines of Downton Abbey. So I'm really, really excited about that. So without further ado, let's just start, shall we? So episode 2 of season 5, I called it the one where some are being convinced. So where do we stand in this episode? Where are we in the timeline? Technically, it starts the day after the previous episode, technically, because they're cleaning up the room after the fire, and I don't see why they would do that like a week after. But the episode ends with the king speaking on the wireless, and that happened on the 23rd of April 1924. So we have 2 months in the course of one episode. Weirdly, I can't even see those 2 months. There's a lot of things that show we're not in winter anymore. But yeah, to be honest, the Downton timeline always confuses me, because I don't think I understand half of it. You know, I try to sometimes investigate when I'm interested, especially when it's about Cora and Robert. But that is what is happening here. So we have 2 months in one episode. And we're going to start just by talking a bit about Jimmy, because it's, well, the end. You know, with what happened last episode, it's like we knew it was the end for Jimmy. I'm not too sad about it, not gonna lie. Jimmy is leaving, and before leaving, he speaks with Thomas. It's quite emotional, I have to say, because Thomas is losing a friend, and even Jimmy says, "You have been a good friend." It's a bit sad, because you see that now Thomas is going to be alone, and that he doesn't really have, he can't blackmail Baxter anymore. So he's really alone. And Daisy and Mrs. Padmore, they talk about him, and Daisy says, "Well, I'm a bit sad that Jimmy's gone." Mrs. Padmore, she says something like, "Yeah, it was nice to have a bony face, you know, in the house. Now we have to deal with Mr. Moseley," which is quite like, it's a bit not nice, Mrs. Padmore, but it's very funny. And then when, you know, they have to serve the pudding, and Mrs. Padmore asks Moseley, "Do you want me to put down another tray?" Or anyone is like, "Oh no, just give you all one." "Oh, where, Jimmy, where are you when we need you?" And Moseley, he's still on his like first footman situation, and he asks Carson, "Does this mean that now I'm first footman?" And I have to say, Carson's answer is, I quite love it. So he says, "Since there is no other footman, you are now the first, second, third, and last." But I just love how he actually wants to know. And you're like, Moseley, there's only you. Like, why? And then I promise she was like, "You know, those days are quite gone." And Carson's like, "Yeah, don't remind me. Don't remind me." But there's a very, very sweet scene between Anna and Thomas. They talk about Jimmy, and she wants to cheer him up. It's really sweet, because when you see everything Thomas has put them through, especially Bates, but so Anna was in it too. But Anna, I do believe she always had, especially I'd say, since Sybil's death, you really feel that she has a soft spot for Thomas, in a way that she knows that he can be vulnerable, that he can have some moments, that he can have feelings. I don't know how to say that, but you're like, she has seen another side of him. And the fact she wants to cheer him up, I think it's very, very sweet. I mean, Anna, she's a sweet person in general. You know, when she says, "Well, we all need a special friend." And he's like, I was not special, not to him. And he says, "Sometimes I'd like to belong." And he's like, "Is it like crazy to admit it or whatever?" And he's like, "No, not to me." And we see that the moment is broken when Bates enters the room. And it's very sad, because I'm very sad that they never, well, for now, never managed to get past this nastiness. Like, I like the teasing, and I like sometimes, you know, when, you know, they're teasing each other, or even sometimes it made some jokes, but it's always very cold. And I thought after the cricket thing and Bates helping Thomas, I thought it would get a bit better. But now with the whole Green situation, and again, as I said it, but I thought it's sad, because if Thomas knew what happened with Green, what Green did to Anna, he would let it go. And I think he would even, weirdly, obviously, been on her side. I think he could have been the one who actually killed Green, and he would have been like, if Bates has killed him, then good riddance. You know what I mean? I already said it, but I'm saying again. And so it's those kind of things where I'm like, damn, like if it had happened that way, things could have been different. So yeah, I'm just rambling. I think you know by now, but because it's been a while, you know, since I've done this, I thought I could ramble a bit. I thought that was a sweet moment. And I do like the relationship between Anna and Thomas, because I think that if there wasn't Bates, they could have been really good friends. But Bates, like, there's an issue there. Speaking of Thomas, let's talk about Miss Baxter and Moseley. Because obviously Thomas is very angry at Baxter because, well, he thinks like she kind of betrayed him and now he has nothing against her. And Moseley keeps defending her, and so he's even more angry because he's like, you don't know what she did. You know the truth. And Moseley's like, I don't care. But because Thomas is angry, he tells Moseley Baxter's secret. And that moment, Moseley, he tries to understand. You see in his face, he tries to, you know, it's like there's more to it. There has to be more than that. But he's crestfallen, like literally, what he's supposed to do with that information, you know? And then Bates comes in, and then we're back in the boot room again. Moseley's there with Baxter, and he tells her that Barrow told him her secret. And he tries to understand. He wants her to tell him, why did you do it? He says, there must be something more. He said, oh, you can't have just took the juice. And then she says, yes, that's the truth. He doesn't want to accept it. And it's so moving. Like, he has tears in his eyes, and it's not possible because he has been now, you know, spending his days with Baxter for a while now, and he can't understand how this person could have done that. And he's outside, and he still tries to make a sense of everything. And he wants to know why she did it, and she doesn't want to say. And so there must have been a reason, something, like, you can't just steal just like that. And it's just, this scene is so emotional. Like, they're both so moved by everything. Like, there's too many things. And she says that she'd give a limb to rewrite this part of her life, but she can't. Really, it's when she says, not even for you, like, my heart is breaking. Like, this is so sad. But I just love how he's convinced that there must be more than that. And he's not alone in this, because Cora also thinks that there's more. Baxter keeps saying, I've told you everything, but she doesn't understand, because again, she doesn't understand why she did it. You must have had a reason. And she doesn't know. She says, well, I don't know why I haven't dismissed you already, you know. Like, you are a thief and you're supposed to take care of my jewels. But then I should maybe have dismissed you because you concealed your past. And she's like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I don't know what to, because again, she senses there's something more. And for once, I'm like, damn, Cora, you're right. Because sometimes Cora is not the best judge of character, you know. I mean, O'Brien, Edna, but for once, Baxter, she is right. Like, you know, the third one is the good one, okay? They should talk, you know, Cora and Moseley. They would be, like, together in this, because they have the same feelings. Like, they're really like, it can't be just that. There must be something more. And they're right. Bananas. Now, Edith. We left last episode with Edith setting fire to her room. The episode starts with Anna and Mrs. Hughes cleaning Edith's bedroom, and Anna finds the picture of a baby, you know, the picture that Edith put under her pillow. Anna finds it, gives it to Mrs. Hughes, and you see Mrs. Hughes, like, her brain is functioning really hard. Like, you can see everything. Like, she's putting the pieces together because she heard Edith and Mr. Drew talking. Like, things are becoming clearer in her mind. I think she senses, and maybe not right away. She's like, oh, that's Edith's daughter, you know, but there's something. And she's like, there's something. Then they're having luncheon upstairs, the family. I really like when they are, because usually, most of the time, luncheon, you don't have, because they're quite a lot, there's everyone, you know, there's Robert, Cora, Mary, Edith, Rose, Tom, Violet, and Isabel. And I think it's quite nice to see them all, but in a more casual setting, because usually it's at dinner and you know, with the outfits and everything, it's much more formal. So I like that. It's quite nice. And the ladies, oh my God, all of them, stunning. I have to say, I love Mary with that haircut. I want to say that now because she will not stay like that forever, but I love Mary with that haircut. And Cora, oh, she just, you miss me, right? I mean, hey, I have been there for a while, so I have the right to say that Cora is so beautiful, and I have the right to say it in every episode, okay? And I do whatever I want, actually. So, no, she's just so incredibly beautiful, I have to say. I just love it. I knew that the style in season 4 was not my favorite, especially at the beginning, but oh my God, everyone looks absolutely gorgeous in that scene. So I just have to mention it. And I talk about the fire. Edie just says, well, I feel such like an idiot. No, it's my fault. And Mary has said, well, maybe because you behave like an idiot. And again, it's another one of this thing that does she have to say that? And it can feel a bit funny, like you see Rose and Tom, they find it funny, but when you have that all the time, it's not funny anymore. I don't find it funny anymore. You know, if it was from time to time, I would say, hey, that's fun. But now I don't believe it is. Like it's not funny. Well, not to me anymore. But then Edith is at the Drews and Mr. Drew has a plan. When she just comes in, he's like, follow my lead. And he says to his wife, he kept saying, oh, it's amazing the interest you've taken into that little girl. Imagine all the great things that you'd be able to do if you take a real interest. I mean, she would be so privileged, it'd be so great because she's just an orphan. She doesn't have any family. And of course, Mrs. Drew, when she hears that, she's like, excuse me, we are her family. She's almost one of her own. Like, what are you talking about? And like, no, but imagine if Lady Edith might take an interest in her. Like, whatever, like, you really, like, it's an act and it feels even a bit too much. He even says, but talk about it with his lordship to see what he thinks about it, because, you know, once you've taken interest, you can't, you know, just back down. Anyway, so then Edith comes to talk with her parents and she talks about the situation that the Drews adopted the little girl and that she likes her and she would like to be more involved, maybe with school fees or whatever, like she has some money of her own and she just wants to have their opinion. Robert thinks it's a stupid idea. Cora, I think she's more like, if you want to, but it's weird because I think Cora senses something more to it, but there's no way she might even think that Edith might have a baby, you know. But there's something, but she's not against it. And Robert is like, you know, it's your money, you do whatever you want, but you can't just back away when you get bored. And Edith is like, I won't get bored. And we know she won't, but they don't know why. And then when Cora and Robert are together in the bedroom, they talk about that. Like, Cora is like, what do you think about this sudden interest about the Drew girl? And Robert, he sometimes has a brain of his own because, as you know, her sisters both have children and she has to live with that, see them play, and she's here and Gregson is probably dead. So I understand why she would feel like that. But then the problem would be when she will have children of her own. And Cora is like, well, we can cross that bridge when we get to it, you know. So funny because they're already on it. But and then Robert obviously has to end on a very, very positive note saying, well, I just hope she doesn't bore them and disturb them like the Drews and drives them all the mad. And he doesn't think it's a good idea for some reasons that they are logical. But the fact that he also understands why she wants to do this, I think it's great. Like, Robert, you're getting on. You have a brain, you use it, it's fine, it's great. And so because they agreed, Edith then comes back to the Drew's house and they talk about the plan. And she's like, I hope we all agree about the plan. But Mrs. Drew, she doesn't. And she thinks that, I like the way she put it because you can feel like that. No, she says, I don't want this to be her dollhouse and Marigold to be her doll that she can play with it and put it aside when she doesn't want her anymore. And this is exactly the moment where I think if Mr. Drew would have said to his wife the truth, she would have understood because she's a mother. She would have understood. And I think she would have kept the secret. Like, she's not stupid. And I think it's sad because when you see it like that, it actually looks like, yes, Edith, she just wants to have a kind of a doll and play with it when we know it's not that. So I am very sad because I can't be mad at Edith for having this solution to keep her child. But I can't be mad at Mrs. Drew for acting like that as well. So everyone was wrong in this. Like, Edith, she should have done something else. But I do believe that Mr. Drew was very wrong to not tell his wife the truth. And this would just get worse and worse. And I think it's very, very sad. Now, on a lighter note, let's talk about Isabel. And now it's even, I wouldn't say it's a love square, because they're not like all in love with the wrong people and each other, but it's like a square of people involved into one relationship. You have Isabel Violet and Lord Merton and Dr. Clarkson. And you know, last episode, Lord Merton asked Violet to help him in his courtship. And Isabel said that she liked him, but she didn't want to marry him. And then Violet, she organized a luncheon where she invited also Dr. Clarkson and Lady Shackleton. And well, let's just say that Isabel didn't have time to talk with Lord Merton. So she's kind of in between the, I like him, but I don't want to marry him. But at the same time, Violet, she's, you know, she tries to get in between them in a way. And we don't know if Violet is not for this relationship because of the fact that if they get married, Isabel would be a great lady in the county. We don't know all her motives, but she's still playing kind of matchmakers or non-matchmakers. I don't know how I would say that, but it feels like also it's very funny for her to do that. So early in the episode, Isabel is with Clarkson at the Dower House for tea, and they even talk about like insulin, and they talk about medical stuff. And Violet says that Lord Merton has invited them, so Isabel and Violet, for tea. And she keeps joking about the fact that, yes, he's still on to Isabel. And Isabel is like, maybe it's you he wants to court. And I'm just, you know, here so he can pretend it's not you. And Violet says, well, you know, I may be old, but I can still tell when the man is interested. But she likes to tease. But at the moment, Isabel, she really gets like a bit angry. So, you know, I can be teased, okay, but there's the moment my sense of humor has its limits, you know. But you can see that Violet, I don't think she has had that much fun since a long time. Like this is, she's like, I'm loving this, really. And no, Dr. Clarkson is still a bit against it because like, oh, I hear that this place has lovely gardens. Too bad it's the wrong season to see them. I do think it's very funny. But so Violet and Isabel, they go to Lord Merton's for tea. And oh my God, Violet, she has to go in, you know, because when they arrive, Isabel's like, well, I know it's the wrong season, but I would love to the garden. And Violet, she's like, well, maybe we should wait and see what Lord Merton has planned for his visit because it's his house, you know. But when they have tea together, Violet, she senses that they really are well together. There's something, you know, there's this little spark. And even if she tries to tease, even her, you see in her face that she senses that, you know, they're well suited, actually, Lord Merton and Isabel, and they get on really well. Lord Merton says, well, this room needs a woman to make you sense of it, you know, like when he says things like, okay, like the guy, he really is interested, like you can't deny it. And I like the idea that he always includes Violet in his plan, I think in a way to not make Isabel too uncomfortable to be just with him. Maybe just because as a custom it would be best. But I think that at the age that they are, I think Isabel could go pay a visit and just have tea with Lord Merton on her own. But I think it's just to not make her too uncomfortable just being them two. In the end, Isabel is uncomfortable because Violet has to tease her all the time. I said it already, but I'm going to say it again. I just love the storyline. And I love also how Violet is committed to it. Now we think she just wants to break them up, but she will get so invested. I mean, she's my hero for that storyline, really. And I just love it. And just, oh, I said it already, but I just love it. And there'll be some heartbreak along the way and it will not be easy, but I really like the storyline. Now let's continue with the Downton Memorial, you know, the memorial for the war, where the delegation came to ask Carson to be the chairman. And now Robert is a patron because Carson asked them to ask Robert to be a patron. And so Robert, Carson and Tom are outside and then they're together with the delegation and they look for a place where to put memorial. And the delegation, they want to put it on the cricket field. Obviously, Robert is like, cricket. This is a field for cricket because nothing is more important than cricket. We all know that, I think, by now. Yeah, and you see Robert's face like, yeah, but there's a lot of work that has been put to this land for the cricket, you know. And what they want is to have a garden of remembrance and have the memorial and a nice garden where people could stay for an hour or two to, you know, think about their loved ones. Robert thinks it would be better in the center of the village where everyone we go around and think about their loved ones when they go or to shop or to work, whatever. And the delegation, they do not agree because they think it's not very peaceful. Like, the young people who give their life for the country should have more than just, you know, something in the middle of the village where everyone just go around. Like, they deserve more. And Robert, he stands on his ground and says, but in this other place, they do it like that. And I suspect this is how it would be done everywhere. And Carson, he has to say, well, it should all memorial be just like everyone else's. But I have to agree with Robert, even if we know that a tiny part is really like just not the cricket pitch. I don't believe that people would just go and take an hour in a garden just to think about their loved ones. Well, I think it's just because it's not a cemetery, it's a memorial. So I don't know, or maybe I just agree with him because that's how it's actually done. You know, the memorials that in the center of the city where everyone like just go next to it and you walk past it, you know. And Mrs. Yu then, she asked Carson about the morning, say, how did you get on? And, well, Carson, he's like, well, no. Like, apparently we did not go well. And during luncheon, they talk about it. And I just love when Robert's like, mm-hmm. Carson is like, mm-hmm. You know, like, not yet, not yet. And they're all like, what happened? It just Tom tries to, you know, let's stay chill. You know, it's hard to please everyone. And Mrs. Hughes asks again Mr. Carson about it, and Carson says that his lordship doesn't agree with their plan. And Mrs. Hughes actually agrees with Robert because she says, I don't believe in your garden of remembrance. Maybe in a big city, but, and she's right, maybe in a big city. So it's like you have a place so everyone can gather, but when you're a small village, why don't you put it in the center of the village? I really love it because Carson, this is a shock for him, and I really like it because he's shocked.
You surprised me, Mrs. Hughes. I was disappointed in his lordship, but I'm more disappointed in you.
Every relationship has its ups and downs.
I just love how Mrs. Hughes is also very surprised by his reaction. You know, they do not agree, okay, but the fact that he's like, I'm disappointed in you, like, okay, so because she does not agree with you, she's disappointment, like, what that's supposed to mean, Carson. Robert and Carson are still talking, and Carson is like, well, I'm not yet convinced. I'm not saying I'm against it. I just need to be convinced that this is the good idea. So then later, Carson says to Mrs. Hughes that he's going to the village with Robert to look at some sites where they could put the memorial. I just love when he says, I don't like it when we're not on the same side. Mrs. Hughes is like, well, we can't always agree on everything. He's like, yes, but I don't like it. And I love it how, you know, she got past this moment of disappointment, you know, because they did not agree. But he was really like, I don't like it when we're not on the same side. Like, this is really important to him. But so together with Robert, they are in the village with Isis, very important. And they talk to a woman who says that her son is visiting his father's grave and that he likes to accompany her to have a chance to go see his father when she goes to the shop, or, you know, when she just walks around the village. And he takes this opportunity to say, oh, because we're going past the cemetery, I want to go there. Basically what Robert and Mrs. Hughes said about the memorial, because people, maybe they're going to go to the shop or going to work, wherever, they're going to go past the memorial, maybe just stop for a couple of minutes to think about their loved ones, and they go back to their life because that's what you do. And this has resonated in Carson and Robert too. Robert, you see that he's a bit happy because he's like, this is exactly the point I wanted to prove. Like, I am right. And so then Carson, you know, he's okay. Like, he had his proof that it's a good idea. But I just love how Robert, he's actually quite happy. Almost to say, I was right. Because it doesn't happen often. So now we can say, yes, Robert, you were right. And your cricket pitch will stay intact. And so Carson, he comes to tell the news to Mrs. Hughes that the memorial will be in the village. And I just love this tiny conversation because, like, you know, I just asked to be convinced, and I am. And they're just so cute.
There's a bonus.
What's that?
It puts us back in agreement, Mrs. Hughes. I'm not comfortable when you and I are not in agreement.
You're very flattering. When you talk like that, you make me want to check the looking glass to see that my hair's tidy.
Get away with you.
No, I mean it.
They're just so cute. I mean, they have been acting like an old married couple since season one, but I just love it. Like, this moment is very, they're very, very cute. And I just love that thanks to this War Memorial thing, we even have more scenes between Cass and Mrs. Hughes, because there's something, you know, there has been something since season one, but I think it's very sweet. And so the memorial will be in the village, and this is a story to be continued. Bananas. Now, let's talk about Rose. Well, not just Rose, because Rose, you know, she's modern. She lives in the present day. You know, she is from this new world. She's part of it, you know. At luncheon, she talks about her Russian refugees. And when they talk about that, Isabel mentions that at the clinic, someone gave people a wireless. And Rose, she's so excited. She's like, oh, but I've heard there's so much easier to tune now. Like, she praises it and she looks at Robert. She says nothing. And he's like, no. And I haven't asked anything. No. I just love it because they talk about it downstairs. And she asks, is it true that Lady Rose wants his lordship to buy a wireless? And Mosley's like, well, she wants it too, but will he do it? Like, will he buy it? That's another story. And it's very funny how, you know, like Mosley's like, no, I think I prefer live performances. And Daisy's like, oh, but it's great, you know, to hear about music like from London. So again, it's two different generations. They think obviously two different things. And I just love how Rose keeps talking to Robert about a wireless. Like, she's just, oh, have you seen this article about wireless, the cousin Robert? He says, no, I thought it was interesting. No. I just love it. I think it's very funny. And then Cora, she comes to see Robert when he's in the dressing room with Bates, and they're sorting out some clothes for Rose's refugees. And she asks him, why are you so against getting a wireless? And he says, you know, sometimes I just wish you would say it. Cousin Robert, buy a wireless. But she doesn't. He's like, but why are you against it? I wouldn't mind. And he's like, well, obviously, because you're American. You're like, okay, mister, you are just better than everybody else. He's like, no, this is something like it's stealing life or whatever. Cora, she tries to get support from Bates, but Bates is like, well, I can't see the dowager with a wireless. Well, that's true. My favorite part is when Robert is like, it's a fad, it won't last. And you're like, well, yeah, not so right about that, Robert. But then Rose, oh my God, I just love it. She just waiting to talk to Robert. She's like, oh, cousin Robert, did you see that the king is going to speak on the wireless? And he's like, are you kidding? Like, don't be silly. She's like, no, he will, you know, on the 23rd for the opening of the British Empire exhibition. And now Robert's like, oh, well, if it's the king. The king wants to speak to his people. We have to listen. And Carson's like, no. And Robert, he says, well, we can still just hire one, you know. We won't get corrupted if you're just in the house for one day. And I love it when just Rose, she asks Mary and Charles Blake if she thinks, you know, they might get a wireless. And Mary is right when she says, well, if he don't get one for the king, then your cause is lost. And that's true. Well, the wireless is at Downton. I just love it how everyone, well, almost everyone is excited. You see Mrs. Papmore and Daisy. And I just love Daisy when she says, why is it called a wireless if there's so many wires? But Rose is so excited when then you hear the music. Mrs. Papmore, she's so cute. Like, she's excited too. Mrs. Hughes, she likes it. And I just love when Mrs. Papmore said, if I touch that, would I get a shock? And cousin, you get shocked only if you listen to it. Oh my God, drama queen always. But I mean, we do love cousin like that. Mrs. Hughes, she's right. She says, we're catching up. Downton is catching up with the times we live in. And cousin says, well, that's exactly what I'm afraid of. I just love this moment. Like, it must have been such a huge thing. Like, really, it's a revolution. I really like the scene, so that everyone is in the hall, so the servants, the family, the kids, and the king starts to speak, and Violet, she stands up. And so everyone, well, the family were the only ones sitting, but so then everyone is getting up, like, okay, if, you know, because Violet's like, well, it's the king, so up, you know. And I really like it, Mrs. Padmore. She's like, I suppose he can't hear us. But I really like it. I think it's exactly what Mrs. Hughes says. You know, it makes him less of a myth and more of a man. And obviously, Isabel agrees with Mrs. Hughes. But I think this whole thing was, I really like this scene. I like when, you know, Darton to talk about really historical events, just like that, punctual events that were such huge thing. And this is one. And so then in the end, Rose and Cora are like, oh, must we just get rid of it now when, I mean, now that we have it? And so Robert's like, well, put it in a small library. And Rose's like, oh, thank you for changing your mind. And Robert's like, well, I don't remember, I was against it. Like, but Rose is very happy. And, you know, it's like with a gramophone, you know, it's very, all the new things, she likes it. I think if they were to be transported in today's world, she would be the first one to be so happy to discover every new thing and find something positive about every new thing. While Robert and Carson would be like, this is just hell on earth. There's nothing good with it, absolutely nothing. And seeing only the bad things, you know. You still do it now, but I think it's quite fun. And she's really happy, and she's just like a little sunshine Rose, and she's just so cute. I love her. Now let's talk a bit about Daisy. We started a new storyline for her last episode. You know, she wants to study a bit mathematics, but she has a hard time with it. And so she talks about her studies with Mrs. Papamore, and she says that it's impossible. Like, it's very slow. She doesn't understand everything, and she feels bad because she wants to learn, but she can't. You know, she has a hard time. And at the moment, Rose is downstairs because Mrs. Papamore wanted to talk to her. And she wanted to ask her about the teacher who was there the last time. So Miss Bunting, you know, she even says, I thought about asking Mr. Branson, but I thought he would be a bit embarrassed. So I thought it was best, you know, it would be a bit awkward. So I thought it was better to ask you. But do you think she might be willing to take some extra work? And so then Miss Bunting is downstairs and she agrees to give Daisy some lessons. And Mrs. Papamore wants to pay. The only issue is that Daisy's lessons would take place at Daisy's busiest hour, but like, there's no choice because Mrs. Bunting is like, well, it's after school because I come before, which obviously makes sense. And Mrs. Hughes is like, well, this is good what you're doing, you know, paying for a lesson. And even because Mrs. Papamore, she took the initiative because she realized that it was something that Daisy really cared about. And, you know, because Mrs. Papamore, she's like a mummy too. Daisy, so she's like, we help her, and she does. And well, she just added some extra work for herself, but I'm with Mrs. Hughes, it's good that she does it. Then Daisy says that she's very happy about her lesson. Like, when Miss Bunting explains it to her, it seems so easy. But it's always, usually, not all the time, but it's usually the case when you want to learn something yourself and you can't, sometimes just because you need to have someone that can explain it to you, and someone. And if this is someone that explains to you in the right way, like, this sounds so easy. So at least Daisy is very pleased with her lessons. And so Miss Papamore, she doesn't pay for nothing. And this is great. I mean, I love it. And it's very, I already said it, but I think it's a very interesting storyline because it really shows that Daisy, she wants to, like, this would give her much more possibilities. And she's so young. It, you know, and she might not end her life in service because the aristocracy would not be the same. It's already not the same as it was before, but it would not be in like 10, 20, 30 years. So it's great because thanks to that, she will have more possibilities. And I think this is absolutely amazing. So because we talked a tiny bit about Miss Bunting, we're going to go now and talk about Tom and also obviously a bit of Miss Bunting. And politics, because this is a big topic. When they're in the drawing room before dinner, Thomas comes to say to Rose and Tom that Miss Bunting is downstairs. And so Rose thinks that they should ask her to dine with them because it would not seem nice, you know, to just leave her downstairs when we say we know she's downstairs, so we should invite her. And Tom is like, I don't think this is a good idea because, you know, like, yeah. You know, he said, I don't think it's a good idea because Lord Grantham, like Robert, he won't be pleased about it. And she's like, well, I'm going to ask Cora. I just love it. Even last episode, did you ask Lord Grantham? Wasn't Cora's permission enough? Because even Rose knows that Robert would say no, but Cora would say yes. It's like when you have, you know, with your parents and you want to ask something to one or the other. And if you know that one would say no, so you ask the other who would say yes. Like, yeah, but like, I don't know, mom said yes or whatever. So I talked to Cora and Cora says that they should give Miss Bunting the option, that they should ask her, do you want to dine with us or not? And when Robert hears that, he's like, you are kidding me. And Cora is right when she says this is the first friend that Tom has made that has nothing to do with us. We must respect that. And Robert makes a joke about a German communist who was shot and thrown into the canal, which, you know, just so much that we wouldn't want that on Miss Bunting. And Robert's like, But I agree. I completely agree with Robert why he doesn't want her to be there, because I think Miss Bunting is just rude. But I also am on Cora's side on the, it's the first time Tom has a friend that has nothing to do with us. You know, we keep saying that it's his home too, but if it can't invite people that, you know, it's not his home. So then Tom asks Miss Bunting, but she says that she will not join them because she says, well, I don't have the strength to put either myself or Lord Grantham through another test of opinions or whatever. So he walks her to a car because he even asked for a car to bring her home. And they talk about his future, whatever. And I agree with her when she says you can be whoever you want to be, you know. But I don't like it when she says you have a future, but not with them. Like, she's so sure. I hate it when Tom did that with Sybil as well. And, you know, we saw that with Tony Gilliam. But I hate when people think at the place of the other. Like, they say, I know what's good for you. Because in the end, the only person that knows who's good for you is yourself. And when she says, you have a future, yes, but not with them. Like, you can't. And she even talks about Sybil. And she doesn't say bad things about her. But I don't really like when people, they bring up. Like, it's like when Tony brings up Matthew. I don't really like it. The way they bring, you know, yes, there's Sybil, but she was so unique. And, you know, and you were the one who made her cross the bridge and whatever. As if, like, Tom is not a hero, but, like, as if he saved her of something. You know, I never liked that couple, like Sybil and Tom. I never believed in it. Sometimes I even think that Sybil was never in love with him. She was just in love of the idea of freedom. But that's another subject. But I hated the fact she said that she's so sure that he has a future, but not with them. The thing I think Tom is always in between is because of his daughter. Because now that, you know, he has made a life a bit at Downton and that the family is attached to him and to Sibby, it's hard for him to say, I'm just going to go back to my old life with my daughter, because his daughter, she loves the family and he loves them too, and she's part of it. And it feels like everyone is forgetting that there's a child in this, you know, as if it's easy to just, yeah, let's just take the child and start somewhere. It's like, yeah. So I don't like the idea that she knows best. So yeah, but again, I'm not a fan of Miss Bunting. And then Miss Bunting has left and Tom goes back into the house and everyone goes into the dining room. Tom says to Robert that she has to go home and he says, what a relief. And Robert, he doesn't make even an effort at all. I hate that too, because his attitude is pushing Tom away. That's where he's not very clever. And so at dinner, Robert, he's the one pushing it. Like, he's the one starting the war. Because they talk about politics, and so it's Robert versus Tom, and they talk about, you know, the Russian and the things and whatever, the Russian refugees and the fact that, you know, all those poor refugees, oh, but Tom, you do not agree, and if Miss Bunting was there, oh my God. And he's like, he sort of said, I'm sorry to everyone who has to leave their home. He said that in the beginning of the episode, he said, but it was against the system. I'm against the system. That doesn't mean I agree for people to get killed. And he said, well, you know, that person killed that person. And Robert's like, well, I didn't kill him. Tommy's like, well, I didn't kill the Tsar and whatever. And so you have this little battle. And like, please stop, you know. And I just love, because they have guests. And I just love how they try to keep it light. Like Mary and Cora try to keep it light. And then so they leave the room. And he said, I don't think we split tonight. And Edith says, well, they will only fight if we do. It's Robert who starts the fight at that moment. It's almost like he wants to challenge Tom, to forces him to pick a side, just like Miss Bunting does. And this is exactly the wrong thing to do. If you want to make him leave, this is what you should do. But like, they are both going to lose in this fight, because making him choose will make them both lose. Because Miss Bunting wants him to choose her side. Robert wants him to choose his side. No one tries to make a compromise and understand that he's in between and that he can maybe stay in the in-between situation, that he hasn't, not everything has to be black and white. And this is exactly what Mrs. Bunting and Robert are doing. And obviously, Tomek is going to fight back with Robert. Robert is really asking for it. So obviously, he's going to fight back. And so then after this dinner, Mary, Rose and Charles Blake are together in the library and they talk about that. And I just love how Rose, maybe because she's a bit outside this whole thing, because she wasn't there when Sybil was alive. And she maybe, I mean, obviously she knew her, but her relationship with Sybil is completely different than the rest of the family. And she just sees Tom as who he is. And she has never met him before. The Tom before Sybil, she doesn't know who he is. She just sees Tom now. And she's like, he has no life outside of us. And Mary's like, it's true. And, you know, since Sybil died, he had no life. And it's great if he has a friend. Maybe it's not for us. That's great, because it, obviously now it feels like he's getting into his old habits. Maybe it's not great for us, but for him, maybe it is. And I just love how Mary, even if she's not a fan of his Bunting, she's not against her, because she sees that Tom, he needs also to have a life. And Cora and Robert, they have this discussion in the bedroom, and Robert, he's very angry. But he brings it on himself, you know. And Cora, she's so right in the scene. I just love also in this whole scene, I'll put the clip after, how Robert is very angry and you sense it, you know, he's in his tone. And Cora, she tries to stay calm about it, you know. She stays calm and she says everything with a calm voice.
Poor Tom. He's nothing more than a ventriloquist dummy for that terrible woman's ideas to come spewing out of his mouth.
But if he feels he has to go, that's what he must do.
Well, he's not taking Sibby.
Don't be silly.
I mean it. I am not having Sybil's only child snatched from everyone she loves to be brought up by some harpy in an American sewer.
If the time comes, then we will talk to Tom. And I suggest we try to be a little more calm about it.
For heaven's sake, can't I be angry when our eldest grandchild is about to be stolen from us forever?
So, but Cora is right, you know, they have to be more calm about it, because being angry would only make him leave. And Robert should listen to her, because she is right. And like he said, she has a brain. Remember, Robert, your wife has a brain and she can use it, actually. You know, no, it's a shock, but she can. The problem is that Robert is angry. But not just with Tom and Miss Bunting. He's angry about something else. And we're going into it now, because this is the start of my favorite storyline, or one of my favorite storylines. Okay, I can't say if it's the one or like number two, but it's one of my favorite storyline of Downton Abbey. And it involves Mr. Simon Breaker. At the beginning, when they are at luncheon, the whole family, Cora says that she had a letter from Charles Blake and he has a friend called Simon Breaker, who's an art historian, and he is writing a book on Della Francesca. And Charles Blake has told him that at Downton they have a painting of Della Francesca, and so he would like to see it. And so Cora says that she will invite him, but ask Charles to come, because since they don't know this Mr. Breaker, it might be better if Charles is here. Then later, when Cora and Robert are coming down the stairs, they talk about Mr. Blake coming with his friend Simon Breaker, and Robert makes a joke again about the fact that, do people think we're some sort of hotel that never gives the bill, like some kind of free hotel? And we're like, Cora saying, well, you've already made that joke. Then it's the day where Charles Blake and Mr. Breaker are here for dinner, and when, again, Cora and Robert comes down the stairs, there's the man in the stairs staring at a painting, and it's Mr. Breaker. And so they talk. She just asks him, when do you want to see the painting? And Cora, she's very nice and sweet with him, but she's nice with everyone. But she says, you can choose whenever you want to see the painting. You can see it now or after dinner or tomorrow. And Robert, he asks him, you just seem, you know, like you have spent winter somewhere else. Like, you seem very tanned. And apparently he was in Alexandria in Egypt. And I just love how Robert said, well, I don't do good at abroad, when Robert is obsessed with ancient Egypt. I just find it really funny that the guy went to Alexandria. And so during dinner, obviously Simon Breaker is next to Cora, and the guy is flirting, but like flirting, you know, And well, obviously she's nice and sweet because that's who she is. And that's also how she was brought up to be. Like, it's definitely in the guidebook of being a good hostess. But he's like really flirting with her. And then they're together with the Della Francesca. It's the same painting that Pamuk is watching just before he kisses Mary in episode 3 of season 1. I say it's the same, but not really, because it's supposed to be the same. But if you watch other two pictures, like if you watch episode 3 of season 1 and this episode, you would see that it's not the same. Like when they made it, they made two different. I don't know how, but it's supposed to be the same in the story, but in reality, it's not the same. I don't know if you get it, but yeah. And so they're together, they talk. Cora explains to him how this painting arrived there. There's Isis with them, very important. And you see they have a nice moment, but you see that the guy is completely under her spell. Like, she was just herself being nice and sweet and whatever, but he is charmed, not just by the paintings, you know, by also the person next to him. But you see how she likes to say things, having someone who actually listens. Like, she talks and he absorbs every word that she says. And, well, first because he's an art historian, so he's fascinated by art and paintings, but also because he's definitely fascinated by Cora. And Robert comes in to say that there's coffee in the drawing room. He's like, yeah, we'll be there. But you see something in his face, because I think at the moment when he says, you know, there's coffee in the drawing room, he thought Cora would be like, yeah, I'm right behind you. But there's, you know, she's like, yeah, we'll be there. Like, almost, I heard you, but I don't really care. Like, I don't pay attention to you. And he doesn't really like that, because when he leaves, like, he calls for Isis and he has Isis to come. And then again, Cora and Robert in the bedroom. It's the same scene where he's angry about Tom and Miss Bunting. He's angry. And he ends this little argument with this line.
And tell your friend Bricker to stop flirting with Isis. There is nothing more ill-bred than trying to steal the affections of someone else's dog.
Very well, I'll tell him to stop flirting.
I just love it because the end of the scene, Robert, you see, he's fuming in bed. You can see it. And Cora, the way she says, I tell him to stop flirting, he sends almost a disappointment in the way that we all saw that Bricker was flirting with her. And he says that he flirt with his dog. Like, why? Because Robert, he's not maybe the cleverest man ever, but he is not that stupid to think that the guy wants his dog. Okay? So is it a way for him to say he wants him to stop flirting with his wife? But I don't think comparing your wife to your dog is the best thing ever. Because it almost feels like she sounds almost disappointed in how it turns out to be. Almost as if, technically, if he had said, stop flirting with you, it says, oh, so you paid attention to me and you realize that someone else is paying attention to me or whatever. Like, I don't know. It's, yeah, I really like this line though. But Robert should just, let's just say that anger makes him completely blind. Like, completely. But this is the start of the Bricker storyline. And just about Simon Bricker. Actually, the first time I watched the show, I was like, I don't know why, but I don't like this man. I didn't know why. Well, at first I thought he smiles a bit too much. Like, you know, the guy smiles all the time. I mean, he's next to Cora, so I probably would smile like an idiot if I was in his shoes. So probably it's because of that. But him smiling all the time, I thought he has this weird, looks like a Ken doll, you know, smiling. But like it almost feels like weird and suspicious. But I couldn't find, because I tried, because usually when I don't like someone, I think, well, I don't really like him, I don't know how, it's because the actor, I saw that person somewhere else and they played someone maybe not nice or whatever. And I tried at the moment when I watched Downton for the first time, I said, I must know him from somewhere. So Simon Bricker is played by an actor called Richard E. Grant. And I was like, I don't know where I've seen this man before. Well, there's something, like, I feel like I know him, but I don't really know him. I don't know. And what I tell you when we get to the bottom, well, half bottom, this is actually quite funny, but to, yeah, it's the end of the Bricker story, but not really the end, because this, I think the story is going to follow us through the whole season, but it has a first end at the middle of season. So maybe I will tell you why I was like, I don't like him. I don't want to say it already, but I had a bad feeling about him. Tell me what you thought about when you saw him the first time. But all I could think was like, Robert, you're such an idiot. Really, whatever. But it's the beginning of the storyline. It's one of my absolute favorite, obviously, because it's about Cobert, but it's even more about Cora, which I think is very interesting. And I can't wait to get to next episode because I adore this episode, but Robert makes me so angry in it, but I can't wait to talk about it. Bananas. And now let's end with Mary. I don't know why I keep it that for the end, but yeah, I did. So remember last episode, Tony Gillingham went into her room to tell her that she was in love with him, because apparently he knows her feelings more than she does, and to tell her that he wants them to be lovers. So this episode, at luncheon, Mary, she says that she'd be away for a week with a friend. They go on a sort of road trip, like sketching road trip. And seriously, when you hear that, you're like, this sounds so not like Mary. Anyway, and I just love that at this luncheon, so it's when Cora talks about the letter from Charles Blake. And Mary says, well, if you want to invite them and you want me to be there, just know that I will be away. This is where I don't understand the timeline, because she's away. So that will be away from Thursday. Oh my God, I just realized I don't understand the timeline at all, because the luncheon is supposed to be the next day of the fire, okay? Maybe it's not the next day, but I would find it weird that they would clean the room. Not the day after, like a week or two after. I don't understand that. But she says that she will be away from Thursday, I think she says. So if she wants to invite Charles Blake and Simon Bricker, then she should do it before she leaves. And then she leaves, and it's during the time where she's away that there's the king speaking on the wireless. But all that can't have been in 2 months. If someone has a clue about this damn timeline, please tell me, because I am in the fog. I don't understand a thing. Anyway, that's the thing. Charles Blake will come with Simon Bricker. I just love when Edith, for once, teases Mary, saying, well, is it not just an excuse for Charles Blake to play in court to Mary? Which, in a way, you would think, yeah, it might be a bit. But so about this trip, Mary is with Anna and they talk about it. And she asks Anna, she says to Anna that I need to ask you to buy something. I'm very sorry, but I must. And so she says that she has a copy of Mary Stopes, Married Life, I think it is the book. It's the same book that Edna had, that, you know, Mrs. Hughes founded. And, you know, because Edna said, I'm pregnant with the whole thing with Tom. And Mrs. Hughes found that and said, well, you know, that was kind of the clue to know that she wasn't pregnant or whatever, you know, seen this book before. So Anna then is in a shop to buy a contraceptive device. And she's very uncomfortable. Obviously, this is still a very, very, very taboo subject. So she buys one for Mary. But you see, she was absolutely not comfortable in this shop, because Mary says, I can't go myself because suppose I'm recognized. And she says, Jenna, but you know, even if you recognize, you're married, your husband is alive. So there would be nothing wrong. You know, people would judge, but there would be nothing wrong with it. So Anna, she buys it. And Bates, he asks her, why do you not go with Lady Mary on her trip? Like, I think it's weird. So, but you know, they don't know where they would stay. They would just ride around. And Bates has the same reaction that I had, that we all have, I think. It's like, this does not sound like Lady Mary at all. It sounds a bit too bohemian. Basically, you tell me Rose is doing that, I'm like, okay, I believe it. Because Rose, you know, having a road trip, I think I could believe it. Even Edith, if you would have said, oh, it's for my article or something, I could have believed it. But Mary, whether she likes it or not, she's very posh. She likes her comfort. So this sounds so not her. And so Anna, she bought the device and she gives it to Mary. And I just love how she's, you know, now I want to buy more. I want to go back and buy more, because I was so judged. Like, what if I was a married working woman with 8 children and didn't want to have more? Like, this is not fair. And she's right. Obviously, she's right. I think it's just very funny how at first Anna, she's like very uncomfortable. And she's like, I will go and buy you a dozen. Then it's Mary. It's the reunion between Mary and Charles. And he says that, but he guessed that he was not the lucky winner. You know, and then he was like, well, you could have told me that I wasn't. You know, it's like, well, it's only recently that I've come out of the mist, you know. And he says, oh, okay, so the lucky winner is Tony Gillingham. She's like, maybe, I don't know. But you see that he doesn't buy it, the whole thing that she might be in love with Tony. Like, we don't neither. But he's like, well, good luck to you both. And so after dinner, you know, so first there's Rose and they talk together, then they're just the two of them. And she says to him, I hope you'll be happy for me if it is Tony in the end. And I really, really like that conversation because he really literally says, Tony is not the one for you. And I really like this conversation, so I'll put the clip now.
Nothing will make me happier than seeing you happy. But please be absolutely sure before you decide.
Why do you say that?
Because you're cleverer than he is. That might have worked in the last century, when ladies had to hide their brains behind good manners and good breeding, but not now.
I don't agree. I think Tony is quite as clever as I am.
Then one of us is right, and one is wrong.
You're not being fair. I'm not some overheated housemaid drooling over a photograph of Douglas Fairbanks.
Plantagenets are as susceptible as housemaids when it comes to sex.
Are we talking about sex or love?
Oh, that is the question that mankind has been wrestling with since the dawn of time.
I really like this conversation because Charles, I don't think Charles and Mary could have been a good couple. I think Charles arrived too early in her life. Maybe later they could have worked, but now they have passed the point, I think, of being lovers, of being, you know, in love. I think they are really good friends. But I think who he is arrived too early in her life. And Tony really represents her old life, even before Matthew. Like, really the kind of man she would have wanted to marry before, because he represents everything that you would like in a husband back in the day. But like Charles says, now it's different. And Mary, they can't work. They will never work. I like when they talk, he mentions sex and Mary's like, are we talking about sex or love? And he's like, well, that's a big question. Because he basically is questioning her motives that you are not in love with him. Basically, you just want to sleep with him. Just say it. It feels almost like it's like that. You want to, like, you don't love him. That's for sure. That's why I understood for that. Like, he almost like he says, you have misunderstood your, even your own motives. I really like Charles, but I still believe that he would not have been a good suitor for Mary, not when he arrived in her life. And I think now, even now, it's like it's too late, technically. Like he was too early and now it's too late and it's weird. But oh, and something I haven't mentioned, completely random, but I haven't mentioned it in the first episode as well, I think. But in the opening credits, so last episode, we had also the name of the actor who plays Tony Gillingham. And in this one, you had his name and the name of the actor who plays Charles Blake, so Tom Cullen and Julian Ovenden, something like that. And you also have now David Robb also in the credits, so that's Dr. Clarkson. And I like that if there are some actors that we have seen a lot, and if they are in the episode now, they are in the credits as well. I don't know if you have seen it, but anyway, so that just means that when you watch the episode, it opens, and you see Tom Cullen, that means Tony Gillingham is here, and I have nothing against this actor, but I just can't stand Tony Gillingham, so I'm like, why? And so then Anna and Mary are together in her room and she has packed her bags and she asks if she's sure, she wishes her good luck. You see how they have a really good relationship because Anna, she is not for this idea. Like she thinks it's a bit crazy, an idea. And even in the beginning when she was really thinking, I need to think about what clothes I should wear because we don't have my help to take them off and put them on. And Mary jokes and say, well, I have his help. And he's like, please. I like when she says, it's best if I never write my memoirs. But I think any servants, like her, especially her and Mrs. Hughes, I hope they will never write their memoirs because, oh my God. I even want to say, especially Mrs. Hughes, because I think she knows way, way, way more than even we think she knows. You know what I mean? And she's been here much, much longer. So yeah, anyway. And so then we see Mary arriving in the Grand Hotel in Liverpool and she's in her room and Tony is next door. Like they have communicating room, like just like, you know, Robert and his dressing room. There's a door and he can go into Cora's room. This is the same. And I have to say this whole scene, I cannot not laugh when she opens the door and his posture. I have to say I laugh because I think he planned to be something a bit sexy. But I don't find him appealing at all. And I still understand what Mary finds in him. I really don't. I think what she likes in him is the fact that he really praises her. And except when he says that she is in love with him, he always agrees with her. Like, it's almost like, oh, you're the best person in the world. Like, there's no argument. You know, like, he's too, like, dull. Sorry. But, like, yeah, there's nothing. Oh my, I'm so, so mean, but he's too bland, you know what I mean? And so they talk and oh my God, his whole speech, I don't find anything appealing. Like how Mary finds that appealing, because he says, we're going to have a sumptuous dinner and then we're going to get home and we're going to make love all night until none of us has no stamina left. It's supposed to be appealing, you know, I think, or arousing or whatever, but I'm seeing that and I'm like, ugh. It feels like he's playing a role. I don't know, like, I don't know. I'm so sorry. I'm keep repeating myself and they kiss and I don't know why I'm like, ugh. Oh my God, I'm so bad. I'm so mean, but I can't with him. Like, and it's even worse because he's not a bad character in there. Like, he's not the Edna or Green and you can't just say, I hate that person. He's just annoying and uninteresting and bland and whatever. So yeah, well, it's almost the end for this episode. But first, this is time for my French words of the day. Well, French words again. Very easy one, because Mary and Tony, they are in a hotel. Well, the word hotel in French is hôtel. And it's exactly the same, except that there is a circumflex accent on the O. But other than that, it's exactly the same. It's masculine, so it's un hôtel, but it's the same. And so, hôtel room, it's une chambre d'hôtel. So, well, it's different because we have two words, like room, you can use it in France, it's either chambre or pièce. And chambre, it's where you sleep, basically. You know, where you sleep and there's a bed, you call it une chambre. And so it's written C-H-A-M-B-R-E. And it's feminine, so it's une chambre. And d'hôtel, it's the apostrophe and hôtel. Yeah, every hotel speaks English in France usually, so you won't probably not need it. But it's funny because I gave you a word that it's pronounced exactly the same way, but it's not the same, it's not written the same. I was when Edith was left at the altar. And the altar in French is also un hôtel, but it's not written the same way, but you say it the same. So a hotel in French is un hôtel and a hotel room is une chambre d'hôtel. Yay! And to end, very end, because you're like, where is the music? You know, I mean, Emma, where is the music? You promised Taylor Swift, where is she? It's now. Yeah, it's now, because you want to know how this happened? I was driving and I was listening to Taylor Swift because that's what I do 99% of the time. And this song was on and I listened to it and I was like, oh my God, this chorus, it's exactly Tony Gillingham at that moment. You know, when he has this kind of a, what he thinks is sexy pose in this hotel that, yeah. You should see the things we do, baby. In the middle of the night, in my dreams. I know I'm gonna be with you, so I'll take my time. Are you ready for it? So that was Ready For It by Taylor Swift. And listen to that and tell me that this is exactly what Tony Gillingham had in his mind. I'm sorry, but yeah. But so this is it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Please feel free to send me a message anywhere and I would love to hear your thoughts about, especially like Tony Gillingham and Miss Bunting and those characters and also Mr. Bricker and all that. I mean, this season is really dear to my heart. And also with the fact that now it's like a bit my comeback. So I would love if you have some thoughts you want to share. That would be really kind. That would be really nice of you. And so, yeah, I will see you next Sunday for episode 3 of season 5. And like I said, I love this episode. I hope you are excited as I am. So I will see you next week for that. And until then, stay safe, take care of yourself. And don't forget,
vive la différence!